The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thanks everybody for coming to this talk. I'm really excited to be able to give this presentation. And sort of the starting point for this presentation is the idea that art is basically a magic, not like actually supernatural magic in which you can, like, you know, conjure elves or something, but actually magic. And that may or may not be controversial to people in this room, but it is something that has historically been somewhat controversial on the left amongst Marxists, but also amongst feminists, anarchists, and certain segment of political artists today. And I sort of went back and forth, to be honest, about like how to sort of introduce the discussion. I thought about good quote, patiently unpacking the issues involved, and so on. But I just decided to be honest instead about why I cared about it. You know, when I was young, I was like a romantic idealist, I wanted to be an artist. I was full of all sorts of, like, you know, ridiculous ideas about what that meant. And then I became a radical and a revolutionary. And the most important thing to me became, you know, the victory of the working class, and also revenge against the ruling class, and so on. And, you know, I think that's I still believe all those things and so on. But a couple years ago, I ended up just kind of like, you know, one of those annoying depressions that happens to people periodically throughout their lives. And the thing that got me out of it was, you know, for whatever freaking reason, I went and, like, bought some paint and some brushes and some canvas and started painting again. Even though I didn't really paint when I was trying to be an artist when I was younger. And it sort of, like, broke me out of the situation I was in. You know, and I started to think about, like, what did that all that mean? Because I'm a committed Marxist, scientific socialism, and so on. I believe the working class can amend, you know, the whole nine yards, or 10 yards. I'm not really sure what 9 yards means. At the same time, I have disliked the utilitarian attitude a lot of Marxists, as well as many anarchists and feminists and so on, have towards art. And as I said before, it's not an isolated sort of thing. It's a historical thing, a utilitarian attitude towards art and politics. And I was convinced that there was a spiritual dimension to art that was important, that it wasn't just merely an extension of ideological conflict, it was something else. So, of course, I tried to read and write my way out of that sort of contradiction. I reread Trotsky, and everybody should read Trotsky on art and revolution, literature and revolution, and so on. You know, Berger, Walter Benjamin, again, all people, Marxists who have written important things about art. But then the book I started to read sort of, like, opened things up for me in a bigger way. Like, you know, and all these things I agreed with, you know, that you can't just sort of, like, hand down political dictates to art. But why is that exactly? And the first book that sort of gave me a glimpse of the way out of that was a book by Michelle Lowy called Morningstar, Surrealism, Marxism, Anarchism, Situationism, Utopia. And Lowy sort of indicated that the greatest enemy to the spiritual side of art is capitalism and class society itself. And he borrowed heavily on the history of Romanticism, the Romantic artistic and literary movements that came about in the late 18th and throughout the 19th centuries. So then I wrote a book that he had written on with another guy called Romanticism Against the Tide of Modernity. And in my opinion, it's the best thing Marxists have written about the romantic artists. Much better, I think, than the stuff Lukács wrote on the subject. And Romanticism was, according to Lowy, the result of a contradiction between capitalism's celebration of individual personality on the one hand, and capitalism's debasement of that individual personality on the other. Sort of the late medieval, early capitalist intelligentsia, artists, writers, poets, and so on, found themselves in conflict with the utilitarian worldview of capitalism when it came to art. These people were trained to see everything in terms of their use values, whether the qualitative value of things, is it good art, is it good philosophy, is it good ethics, and that is not how capitalism is run at all. Capitalism is run based on the value of exchange, and so on. The Romantics, of course, look back to an idealized pre-capitalist, sometimes pre-class past. They counterpose spiritual and humanistic values against the rational, quote-unquote, worldview of capitalism claimed to represent. They wrote against the dark satanic mills of industry, that's William Blake, and celebrated the night in the poetry of Novalis, because at night industry ceased or slowed, and the possibility of magic returned to the world, the possibility of enchanted relationships between human beings and nature, and between human beings, relationships that they saw torn asunder by the Industrial Revolution and capitalism. And so I sort of came to the opinion, I came to the opinion, that Romanticism and its offspring were sort of the instinctive defense of art's spiritual functions, spiritual side, under an economic system that sees everything in utilitarian terms. But I still didn't answer, why does art have this function? Why does art have this spiritual side? So I tried to go back to the source to read about Paleolithic art, the art of primitive communism, you could say hunter-gatherer societies and so on. You can see some Paleolithic art on the wall from the Chauvet Cave in France. And I wrote this little article as part of a debate with comrades at Red Wedge about the nature of Romanticism and art. And then I had the good luck to bump into this artist named Buzz Spector, who does these amazing sculptures with books and out of books. You should check him out. He told me I needed to read Ernst Fischer. I had never heard of Ernst Fischer at all. He's not in the pantheon of, you know, genuine revolutionaries that most Marxist revolutionaries would look to. And he's not a widely read academic Marxist either, as far as I can tell. He's not up there with, you know, Benjamin or Adorno or, you know, all, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I started to look into Ernst Fischer. Fischer, you know, he was a member of the Austrian Communist Party from the 1930s until his expulsion in 1969. And he wrote and did truly objectionable things as a leader of the Communist Party of Austria. He wrote a pamphlet denouncing Trotskyism, which is pretty much standard for, you know, Stalin stuff at the time. He also wrote a play of all things about the Tito-Stalin split, which I have not read, but I imagine is either the best play or the worst play ever written. But despite all this, he ended up writing some of the most, I think, important Marxist texts on art at the time, in particular his 1959 book, The Necessity of Art, which I think is best read in tandem with Engels on the origin of the family, and particularly on the role of labor in the transition from ape to man. Fischer was born in 1899 to a low-level imperial officer in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and then a mother from a declining aristocratic background. His father was a crude anti-Semite, and his mother was a lover of art who also happened to sympathize with the workers' movement. They were obviously miserable people. Fischer spent most of his childhood sick, oftentimes near death. He recovered just in time to volunteer. He did volunteer for duty in the First World War. He was not particularly political, but he was somewhat rebellious. He's got a great autobiography, everybody should read, called An Opposing Man, I believe it's called, over there. When a colonel dressed around Fischer's fellow soldiers for being unkempt and dirty, Fischer suggested to the colonel that if his men had access to the colonel's villa and his servants, they would probably look more presentable. When the war ended and the Imperial Army fell apart and they were retreating from the Italian front, Fischer fell asleep on a farmer's cart and woke up to find out the officers of the army had all been fired by the soldiers and that he had been elected to serve in the new soldiers' committee. Which was pretty much the most political thing that had happened to him at this point, and it happened to him while he was sleeping. He returned to his hometown of Rosch in provincial Austria, excuse me if I'm not pronouncing everything correctly. This was the decade of quote-unquote Red Vienna. In Austria, the Austro-Hungarian Empire fell apart. The Social Democrats pretty much ran Vienna for much of that time. They held back, of course, the revolutionary ardor of the workers. But at the same time, they diverted Vienna's resources into social welfare programs, public works, and the arts. And there was a real sort of intellectual and political fervor in Vienna at the time. Provincial Austria was somewhat different. It was plagued with anti-Semitism, pan-Germanic bitterness. This bitterness was directed against the quote-unquote Reds and Jews in the capital. The SPD counted votes, reaction gained steam throughout all this time. But while all this was starting to happen, this was beyond the grasp of the young Ernst Fischer, who was returning home from war. His family had become déclassé and poor. He got work in a briquette factory and started studying German literature in college. His entry into social democratic politics came about in an odd way. There was an exhibit of expressionism that came to town. Here's an example of German expressionism. Although the exhibit that came to his town was not this radical. It was a more subdued form of expressionism. The bourgeois papers called it cultural Bolshevism. Fischer wrote a favorable article about the exhibit. The only paper in town would publish it was the Social Democratic Party's paper. A few days later, they actually offered him a job writing at the Social Democratic Party paper in town. He was not a member of the party. He had never read Marx. He had only a vague sense of the issues around the Russian Revolution from his days at the front. And throughout the 1920s, as Fisher educated himself politically, he was still primarily focused in on artistic questions, pretty much up until 1927, when there was a crisis, in which there was a mass strike in Vienna, primarily, that was in some way sabotaged by the Social Democratic Party. Fisher was driven to become part of the left opposition of the Social Democratic Party. And at this time, I'd say he had been promoted in the party press. He was one of the editors of the main Social Democratic paper in Vienna, the Arbeiter Zeitung. But ultimately, the party's failure to stop fascism, to stop Hitler, to stop the forces of reaction, led him to flee the country and join the communists. And throughout World War II, he worked in Moscow. He had come to think that the Soviet Union and Stalin were the only things that could really stand in the way of fascism. After the war, after the Nazis left Austria, and after a wave of anti-fascist protests, he returned there. He was briefly a government minister in 1945. But he remained loyal pretty much to Stalinism completely until, of course, the 1956 speech in which Khrushchev revealed the extent of Stalin's crimes. And of course, even then, Ernst Fisher continued to believe the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc were socialist, but he set out to correct, as he saw it at this point, the cultural and artistic policies of communism. He sought to open up literature to freer expression, to get rid of or at least modify the stultifying official style of socialist realism, and to help the quote-unquote socialist world catch up to the artistic innovation of the West. He had some modest success. This is, I just put this here because it's sort of indicative of the absurdity of some of the cultural policies in Eastern Europe. This is a drawing that was repressed for criticizing Soviet plumbing, even though that's not what the drawing is about. He had some modest success. For example, he helped organize the first academic conference on Franz Kafka, the author Franz Kafka, who famously wrote The Trial, Metamorphosis, and so on, in Eastern Europe. For obvious reasons, Kafka was on the shit list of most commissars. They did not want people reading about arbitrary police states. But Fisher was a huge a lover of Franz Kafka. But his goal of reforming the Soviet bloc was ultimately a fool's errand. His belief he could reform the socialist East only began to falter when Russian tanks crushed the Prague Spring and the Czech idea of socialism with a human face. He was expelled from the Austrian party for his support of the Czech protesters and the Czech reformers within the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, and died a few years later in rural Austria, surrounded by friends, including the British art critic John Berger, who wrote Ways of Seeing, which everyone should read, his wife, and old friends from the Austrian resistance to the Nazis. He never really broke, even at that late time, from the popular front politics he learned as a communist in the Communist Party. He's certainly had not broken from those ideas in 1959 when he published The Necessity of Art. Fisher was a flawed human being. He was a flawed socialist. He certainly was a flawed playwright. But Fisher aimed at The Necessity of Art to get to the source of art's nature, to get to sort of why art is the way it is from a Marxist materialist standpoint. And the result is a book that is flawed, but also I think one of the most important Marxist books on the origins and functions of art and society. Fisher makes theoretical mistakes in the book, partly of his own accord, but partly also because he has an eye on the communist censor in Eastern Europe. So for example, he undialectically separates issues of form and content because he wants to be able to say at a certain point the Eastern regime should not censor form in any way, shape, or form, but they should reserve the right, if need be, to censor the content of our works. So he makes a number of mistakes along those lines. But the, like I said, the most important thing Fisher does is provide a historical materialist account of art itself. Now, although he doesn't use these words exactly, Fisher basically argues that art has both a social, undialectically separate them, but a dual social spiritual function. And it has this function because of its role in the evolution of human beings. He argues, and again, this language is dated, it's 1950s language, so the use of pronouns and so on is sexist. He says, art is almost as old as man, it is a form of work, and work is an activity peculiar to mankind. Human beings became human beings through the use of tools. The use of tools created an entirely different relationship between us and our environment. and altered the human mind. Our interaction with nature became mediated, and in that mediation came consciousness. Marx famously described, of course, the difference between human and animal labor with the example of a spider spinning its web. The spider is an architect of instinct. Human beings, on the other hand, have learned how to conceive of the fruits of their labor in the abstract. We imagine and plan, we maximize the use of tools and material in a different way. We can imagine things that don't exist, and once we've created in our mind, we can actually set out to create it in the quote-unquote real world. Art is, in a sense, that same principle applied to an even larger scale. The use of tools and the development of consciousness allowed early human beings to project that consciousness onto all of existence. With tools, as Fisher puts it, nothing was any longer in principle impossible. Our ancestors made tools. One of the things that happened was they generalized about them. They created the concept of the axe, and they started creating the concept of the most optimal axe that they could create. They invented the idea of the best shaped stone in order to cut wood or kill animals. They generalized about nature itself. They began to categorize the different flora and fauna. They identified the cycles of light and weather. They learned the best times to hunt, the best tools to use, the best times to gather plants, and the rhythms of sexual reproduction. Our abstract knowledge of the world became more and more complex as we went through this process. The world became a larger and more complicated system, but it had patterns, and we could understand and know what they meant. So basically, and this is basically what Engels argues in the transition, the role of labor in the transition from ape to man. Through a dialectic of hand and tool and brain and mouth, we produced a social culture, a knowledge of the world, and we became, through that process, biological humans. Now, Fisher basically goes through this, and he locates, again, as I said, art's sort of origins in this process. Some of his anthropological evidence is outdated. 1950s linguistic theories were pretty overly simplistic. A lot of the assumptions about gender are wrong. And the theories about cave art were also mistaken in the belief that our ancestors painted, for example, these animals on the walls of caves as a right to aid in hunting. That isn't really true. Our ancestors painted things that they didn't eat, that they didn't hunt. It's actually much more complicated. But one of the best current theories, and it has to be incomplete because we can't go interview these folks, is that this art has strong shamanistic elements. This argument holds that a lot of Paleolithic cave art was inspired in part by transhallucinations that were a result of drugs, or more likely fasting, meditation, dancing, or sleep deprivation. So while these paintings had a magical or spiritual quote-unquote dimension, they were about the entire world. They weren't just about the immediate needs of the hunt. They were also planned compositions. I could get it, if people want to talk about it, I can get into why anthropologists think they were also planned, but I'm not going to, because there's not enough time to get into the science of it. Therefore, there was a mystical sort of inspiration, but there was also a sober plan, a composition, a conscious composition that went into developing a lot of prehistoric cave painting. Fisher basically is guilty of, well, he reproduces something these anthropologists were guilty of at the time, simplifying the complex motivations of quote-unquote primitive human creativity, when creations were either seen as totally irrational in some way, or base, must kill antelope and eat. It was actually more complex. Material necessity drove early human beings, just like it drives us, but they developed complex myths and aesthetics connected to their material needs. And they projected that quote-unquote magic, which Fisher argues is the forerunner of science and art. Well, he argues it's the forerunner of religion, and then it becomes science and art later on down the road over all of existence. And because of it, there's also sort of a long-standing desire in art and literature to return to the source of language or the source of art. It was this is a picture of Hugo Ball. It was he was part of the Dada art movement in Zurich of draft dodgers during World War I. And he performed these poems called Prosa ohne Worte, poetry without words, where he, along with others, I said, formed the Dada. He wanted to return to an original language. After all, the way they were looking at it, and Dada was German, French, and English had failed Europe. The languages were insufficient. This was also a motivating factor, for example, in the New York School post-World War II abstraction in the United States, trying to find universal visual language. Many of those artists were obsessed, of course, with war and the atomic bomb. They also thought art could tap into some sort of collective unconscious. This is a Robert Wetherill painting, an abstract expressionist painting. That's also sort of a part of a series he did that were monuments to the Spanish Republic. to the artist, the original art, the original language, is often shrouded in mysticism and wonder. The source is sort of a holy grail, a return to the unification of humanity that was torn asunder by class society. Scientifically speaking, the source of language and art is the abstraction of human labor. The words for fire, axe, for spear, lion, mountain, sex, milk. We created those words, and those words in turn shaped how we thought of the world. We projected these words and images on all the things we did not yet understand, the secrets of death, of disease, of birth. The logic being, if naming the axe can give you power over the axe to understand how to make a better axe, perhaps naming whatever happens to you after death might give you power over death itself. Fisher argues the magic at the very root of human existence, creating a sense of powerlessness, and at the same time a consciousness of power, a fear of nature together with the ability to control nature, is the very essence of art. The first artists, of course, were also the first scientists. The first person to shape a stone, the first person to name a tree, the first person to carve a flute and bone, the first person to mark their tools with a design. Our ancestors also went on to make generalizations and assumptions based on what knowledge they had, offered improbable theories, or provable theories, I should say, about the nature of life in the world. Sometimes wonderful, amazing theories, like one of my favorites, that the Earth is on the back of a turtle swimming through a cosmic ocean. I think that's a fantastic idea. It's not true, but it's great. Primitive communist art was a collective production of experience born of a dialectic between power and powerlessness, knowledge and mystery. But even at this early stage, when art was primarily or completely a collective activity, there was an individual subjective element. Hunter-gatherer societies produced, as I mentioned earlier, a form of shamanism. It's different in different places. We can't know what it was like everywhere. We can only get a sense of it from firsthand anthropological accounts that are often colored by the fact they're done by Europeans, and then, of course, by studying what we can gather from the past through anthropology, which is a very useful but problematic science. But anyway, a form of shamanism in which a person enters an altered state of consciousness and brings back knowledge from the, quote, spirit world. These quests became intermixed in the rituals and art of hunter-gatherer societies. And this is another way to see it sense, and we don't know if this is the only way in this research is true, but this is a way we can actually measure it, that there was a sense of cosmic play in the first artworks. It wasn't just, we must go hunt this, or completely irrational. There was a sense of playing with the language that we created to represent the world. As I said before, we did not paint on walls simply to help us hunt better. Our ancestors created an entire world of stories and myths. Those stories and myths were partly based on the individual creativity of the shamanistic rite. And paradoxically, the rise of class society threatened both the collective and anarchic individuality of prehistoric art. Specialization and division of labor made the production of art a specialized craft, inaccessible to most people. The new ruling classes directed art towards their own needs and the needs of new organized religions. Some early agricultural societies even tell mythological accounts about the overthrow of the shamans by the new priests. The shamans became clowns in these stories, the sort of fools of an ignorant past. Fisher argues the perfect unity of man, animal, plant, stone, and source of life and death, collective and individual, is a premise of every magic ceremony. But that might be going too far. I think there's some assumptions in that, but I think it's true enough for the purposes of this discussion. He says, basically what happens with the division of society into social classes, art begins to communicate a longing for a lost unity, a unity lost to the human race. Of course, the surplus wealth of class society was a big step forward for society in many ways. It led in fits and starts to countless scientific and artistic renaissances, but it came with a huge price. As Marx argued, the differentiation of skills, division of labor, separation of social classes, increasingly alienated human beings not just from one another, but in capitalism, from their own selves. The idea of a lost golden age took root everywhere in art, and with it also, at times, millennial ideas about the end of civilization itself. Ideas that appeal to sections of the oppressed at all times, but ideas that also appeal to the ruling class in times of social decay. Generalized commodity production, capitalism, made alienation full and complete. And Fisher goes through this. He says, like, the merchant's relationships to his commodities were depersonalized. He was able to develop a distinct personality separate from his property. The ancient we gave way to the modern I. Workers, of course, got alienation in spades, tethered to the machines of the Industrial Revolution, becoming extensions of capital itself, extensions of dead labor, of past exploitation. And of course, if capitalism did this thing, these things to the capitalists and to the workers, it also fundamentally changed the world of the artist. As Michel Loewy and Robert Serre argued in Romanticism Against the Tide of Modernity, in this generalization of the marketplace, culture, art, and literature were by no means spared. In the second half of the 18th century, intellectuals, artists, and writers became, to a vastly greater extent than ever before, free agents in the various marketplaces for their cultural products. The system of patronage increasingly gave way to the sale of books and paintings. The producers of culture thus found themselves confronted with a contradiction between the use value and exchange values of their products. The new socioeconomic system affected them in their innermost reaches. Or as Fisher puts it, pre-capitalist society tended toward extravagance, carefree spending on a vast, lavish scale, entertainments, and promotion of the arts. But capitalism puts no such value on art. For capitalism, the point of exploitation is more exploitation, accumulation for the sake of accumulation. As Marx put it, that is Moses and the prophets. Patronage of the arts was replaced by the art market, a publishing market, buying theater tickets. Artists became speculators, speculators of their own selves. Fisher writes, for the first time in history that mankind, artists became free artists, a free personality, free to the point of absurdity, of icy loneliness. Art became an occupation that was half romantic, half commercial. Capitalism meant sober calculation and a puritanical slide rule. So at the same time, capitalism denigrated and freed art. Capitalism, Fisher writes, is not essentially a social force well disposed to art or that promotes art. Insofar as the average capitalist needs art at all, he needs it as an embellishment or as a good investment. On the other hand, it is true that capitalism released tremendous forces of artistic as well as economic production. It brought into being new feelings and ideas and gave the artist new means which to express them. While capitalism was basically foreign to the arts, it nevertheless favored their growth and production of an enormous range of many-sided, expressive, and original works. Capitalism gave us Romanticism, the primal cry of the artist trying to preserve ancient art's ancient social and spiritual roles, and then it gave us 200-plus years of artistic innovation, quite rapid by any standard, the succession of modernist avant-garde, from Impressionism to the postmodern, quote-unquote, fragmentation of contemporary art, to just speak of visual art on its own. Capitalism, this is the sort of the process by which capitalism distilled art and science separately from religion. To his credit, Fisher doesn't really try to define art, I think as far too many Marxists have done. And I think this usually is a formulation along the lines of art is non-alienated labor, which I think, I don't know what everybody here thinks, but to me it has a benefit of being simple, but all the usefulness of saying the sky is blue. It doesn't really tell us a lot about what it is specifically. Fisher tries instead to locate, as I mentioned, the function of art, which I think is a more useful approach. He provides one popular answer from the Pater Mondrian, which is the idea that art is a life substitute, a substitute for an incomplete life. Mondrian was a futurist, and he believed that modern life got better and better and better, which of course it was bound to do. Life would become so absolutely fabulous that we would no longer need art at all. Fisher disagrees with Mondrian's futurism, his idea that, you know, modern life is getting, you know, inexorably better and better and better, but not entirely with the idea that art is a life substitute. He thinks that it's something other than that, though. He believes that human beings, all levels of development, all levels of social development, rebel against having to consume themselves in the confines of their own lives. Once we as human beings became conscious of ourselves, through evolution, through the evolutionary process of labor, it was no longer enough to merely live our own lives. Art allowed us to become more than ourselves and allowed everyone else in humanity to become more than themselves. At a very simple level of storytelling, this is obvious. You know, art allows, you know, for example, a medieval farmer to become a knight, a plains hunter to become a hero in the creation myth, allows men to become women, or vice versa. It allows the eye to see what the eye actually can't see. It allows lonely people to imagine they're loved. It allows the songs of nature to be amplified, and it can fill the unknown, the things that we don't understand, the nothingness of death, with spirits and stories that reflect and mock our own fears. Fisher also argues that since art is born of the contradiction between human development and the absence of human development, art is also about the contradiction between being absorbed in reality, or a simulation of reality, and the excitement of controlling it. In this sense, art is about a conflict between reason and emotion, about losing control and being in control at the same time. You know, you go to the film, a play, a ritual, or whatever museum, it can all be understood, it's all manipulated by other human beings or by yourself if you're a part of it. And you can also be consumed by these things that we have created at the same time. Art is both a conscious and subconscious activity at one at the same time. And I think this is the sort of magic you can quote unquote talk about. I should have put my air quotes in one sentence earlier, whatever. This is sort of magic that happens when you know the colors of a Rothko painting. Now, my favorite thing about Rothko is like when you see a picture of it, people say, I can do that. but actually in real life, when you like stand right in front of it and stare at it, the colors envelop you, right? They start to surround you. You're surrounded by these fields of color. It's also, I think, you know, the cacophony of sound in Fear of a Black Planet. That's the kind of magic you're talking about, or the trumpeting host in Beethoven's Ode to Joy, or one of my favorite stories, the archaeologists, almost all of whom are atheists and agnostics who study the ancient cave art. Standing before, and you hear the story time and time again, these people are, as I said, almost all atheists and agnostics, standing, watching the thousands, 10, 15, 20, 30, 40,000 year old paintings on the walls of these caves, being sure that the people who painted these things are ghosts watching them as they watch the art. Again, committed atheists, and they become convinced that this is happening. They're overcome with emotion. In art, Fisher argues, reason and emotion are always bound together. He quotes some interesting things from Bertolt Brecht to this effect, the German Marxist playwright, where Brecht argues, in class society, and particularly in capitalism, an unproductive conflict between reason and emotion has been created. An unproductive, I believe it was put in a really great talk yesterday morning on Marxism, or Halloween, it was very good, I wish you could listen to it if you didn't go. But capitalism gets you coming and going. And I think that's this is a clear case of this. Reason and emotion are equally mocked in capitalism, depending on the situation and depending on the needs of capital. Fisher is aware, of course, that art evolves. He's not saying that it's static, that it never changes. As he says, the raison d'etre, the art never stays entirely the same. The function of art in a class society at war with itself differs in many respects from its original function. But nevertheless, despite different social situations, there is something in art that expresses an unchanging truth. So Fisher turns to Marx for an explanation. Why is this the case? Why is this this unchanging truth in art? And he turns in particular to Marx's attempt to discern why ancient Greek plays and comedy still spoke to a 19th century audience, despite the seismically different social relations that existed between 19th century Europe and ancient Greek society. And Marx's answer is that each moment of cultural development contains a sort of promise of development. It's almost like a snapshot, sort of like the human race's family photos. You can see what we could have been, you know, when we were young and so full of piss and vinegar in ancient Greece. I think this is part of the explanation, but I think I do think that it's not enough for me or for Ernst Fisher. There's something else, this thing inherent in art itself that comes from the moment in which it began to be developed along with human society. And Fisher argues, we may conclude from a constantly growing wealth of evidence that art in its origins was magic, a magic aid towards mastering a real but unexplored world. But whether art soothes or awakens, casts shadows or brings light, it is never merely a clinical description of reality. Its function is to move the whole man, to enable the eye to identify with another life, to make all its own what it is not yet capable of being. Even a great didactic artist like Bertolt Brecht does not act purely through reason and argument, but also through feeling and suggestion. And Fisher concludes, art is necessary in order that man should be able to recognize and change the world, but art is also necessary by virtue of the magic inherent in it. In other words, human beings still need, biologically and psychologically, to project our imaginations across things that we do not or cannot fully understand. We have an ingrained need to name the things that haven't been named yet. Fisher does not provide us, I think, with a complete picture of what that means. His book goes on to talk in a good way about many art movements and in a problematic way about socialist realism. I think to round out the picture that Fisher does, the sort of innovations that Fisher has in terms of where art comes from, you have to read Trotsky, Walter Benjamin, and John Berger, amongst others. And certainly art is a product of social relations. And the art of any given time reflects those relations. Art has a social role, which is one that can buttress or undermine dominant ideologies in society, or more often than not, do both at the same time. But we can see that art also has this spiritual role, a product of how art originated in human evolution, a role that resists certain kinds of scientific understanding, the free projection of imagination onto existence itself. And as such, art abhors utilitarianism. It resists external discipline from the art market, from the censor, from the ruling class, but also, even when it's from the social movements that art sympathizes with, it resists external discipline. I believe in a genuine socialist society, we will not see art become a mere appendage of the working class or of a political party. We'll see a renaissance of expression, free expression without constraint amongst the entire population. Art will no longer be something for specialists. We'll see an ancient free creativity of the human race unleashed. Or as Fisher put it, in a truly human society, the springs of creative power will gush forth. The artist's experience will no longer be a privilege, but the normal gift of free and active men. We shall achieve, as it were, social genius.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.